Welcome to Hassling the Paranormal. Before we get to the show, I want to wish a happy Mother's Day to my mother, Sue Piccioni, and a very special first Mother's Day to my daughter, Mariah. Thank you for listening to Hassling the Paranormal. I'm your host, Jason Hassler. Today's guest is Mark Marcel. He's in studio today to talk about the Ape Canyon Mountain Devil story. I hope you enjoy the show. All right, welcome to the show, Mark. So what led to your interest in Sasquatch?
I believe that it was probably, like you and I talked about before, I believe it was 1976, famous movie called Sasquatch, Legend of Bigfoot. And my joke is as an acronym spells slob. But it was a documentary of some folks going up, I think, north into British Columbia. And it was mainly a documentary regarding Sasquatch and the search for the phenomenon.
Yeah.
But in there was about a 10 or 15 minute segment of the famous 1924 Ape Canyon attack. And it was, up until now, it was like the seminal recreation of the Ape Canyon events. And they did actually a very good job on it. But when I was young, watching it on KPTV Channel 12 Portland when I was a kid after the Late Show, after the Portland Professional Wrestling, I remember that episode, you know, I remember that segment, and frankly, it scared the hell out of me, you know, seeing these huge shadowy figures up on the cliff, throwing rocks down onto the cabin with these scared miners shooting back at them, and it stuck with me. And it wasn't until, about 15, 20 years ago, I've always loved to hang around the lower regions of the Dewey Decimal System at the library. And actually, it was right here at Fort Vancouver. And I'm looking, you know, where Pyramids and Atlantis and all that jazz is. And I picked up a book by Nick Redfern, who mainly specializes in UFOs and El Chupacabra. He's from England. But he wrote this great book called Three Men Seeking Monsters. And this is while he was living in just outside of London. And he and two buddies get into a crappy old van and they head down southwest to Cornwall to research a 100-year-old story called The Man Monkey. And it was later in the book of Redfern's book where he promulgated this idea where, as John Fort says, if you have incidences of high strangeness that you're researching, no matter what it is, lights in the sky or monsters, if you look around the general timeline or if you look around the general geographic area, you will also find other seemingly unrelated incidences of high strangeness. And the idea really grabbed me. So I pulled two stories off the shelf and to purposely test it. And one was a strange incident in the late 70s, 80s down in Yamhill County outside of Sheridan. And I started re-researching that. I was somewhat involved with it. And at the same time, I was researching the 1924 Ape Canyon attack. And growing up in the Pacific Northwest, I'm 58 years old.
Okay.
And most people of my age, since Sasquatch was so huge in the 70s, you know, in pop culture, most people had heard about the Ape Canyon incident. And it was written about in small little paragraphs here and there. But I got into re-researching it as if I had never heard about it before. And it was like, you know, the classic goofball story of like, oh, my girlfriend's coming over, quick, shove everything in the closet. And she shows up and I'll just hang up my coat in the closet and there's this avalanche, you know. And so that's what I found with Ape Canyon. And the Sheridan story is still on the burner. it's kind of coming closer to the front burner.
Yeah.
But Ape Canyon, I mean, there is so much information, and there still are leads out there as far as re-researching this story. So that's kind of a long-winded thing of how I got involved in the Sasquatch world.
All right. So for the listeners who are unfamiliar with the Ape Canyon story, can you tell the story of what happened to those people?
Oh, sure. It basically took place between 1918 and 1924, where the first 4 years were somewhat undramatic, where in 1918 they started heading east of Woodland along the Lewis River, and the core group of these prospectors, they weren't miners yet, but they were looking for a location. These guys were out of Kelso, Longview, and they had grown up in the age of big timber, working the mills. The older folks like Marion Smith and Gabe LaFever had pulled, it was in the age of big timber before, you know, long before truck logging.
Yeah.
And they'd been up in the mountains and seen everything that there was to see, and they knew that there was gold coming off of Mount St. Helens. So they started looking all along the Lewis River, where there are gold locations. Eventually they turned north and ended up laying a claim in 1922 in the most dangerous, precipitous place. It was the craziest place to start a gold mine, right up around the east shoulder of Mount St. Helens, right at the timberline. Well, in 22, they started hearing where they were tent camping at the time. You can't stay up there year round. There's just too much snow.
Yeah.
So they were coming in and tent camping at the base of Pumice Butte, about a mile from the center of the mountain. And they'd hear these high-pitched whistling noises up on the ridgeline. And then they would hear an answering call from another ridgeline, and the sounds would go back and forth, back and forth. They started seeing prints in the sandbar, and it was strange enough where they're starting to see these large hair-covered creatures up there. And Marion, he was about 62 at the time, he got spooked, and he was like, nobody leaves the site unarmed. Everybody has to have a gun.
Yeah, that makes sense.
When, despite that fact, this was about 6 miles from where they had to park their car up at Spirit Lake. Despite that fact, when the season ended, probably like around October, November in 1923, they decided when they were going to come back in 1924, they were going to build a cabin right by the mine. So a cabin that was strong enough to, you know, keep their tools, keep some stores, so they didn't have to haul their stuff back and forth every season. Well, just before the 4th of July, one of their earliest sightings was Fred Beck and Marion Smith are going to the spring about 75 feet from where they're building the cabin. And they see this large hair-covered bipedal mountain devil, as they called him, peeking out from behind a tree. Fred takes 3 shots at it, and they go down to about 300 feet away. And they know they had the right tree because they could see the bark had skinned off from Fred's bullets. And they look up the draw a few hundred feet away, and there's this big bruiser just walking up the draw like it didn't have a care in the world. They go back to 4th of July back in Kelso to join their family. And the interesting part about it is that the Smith and Beck family, or the core group of miners, they had a sterling reputation. They were known as hardworking guys, honest, just square dudes. But they're coming back and telling their friends and family at 4th of July of this ape man up on Mount St. Helens that they took pot shots at. So they return after the 4th, and they're up there for only a week, and all hell breaks loose. At one point, Leroy Smith, he was about 18 or 19, the youngest of the crew, he's coming back from the spring. The guys are in the mine, and there's a brush rustle, turns around, and there's this big individual creature coming out of the brush. Leroy takes shots at it, about 2 or 3 shots, and the creature, unaffected, just turns around and walks back in the brush. This is only about 50 feet away. It's nearly, I'm not a gun guy, yeah, but I couldn't miss that shot, you know.
Probably not.
And so a couple days later, on Thursday, July the 10th, the guys are in the mine, and it's getting quiet, and Leroy, again, is coming back from the spring, sees this individual at the top of the cliff right by the cabin, takes the shot. The guys inside the cabin hear it, and they come boiling out, and they just start shooting this creature. Marion, in his interview, estimated that about 16 rounds between all of them went into this creature. Either Fred Beck took the last shot, and either the creature fell down into the canyon or crouched down and climbed down into the canyon. Mind you, this is an incredibly dangerous area, and at that time, the edge of the canyon was about 10 feet from the the cabin, and then it just simply drops down like 200 feet down into the bottom. Well, they're in the cabin, and they're like, you know what? This is nuts. This is just crazy. Let's get the hell out of here in the morning, you know? So about dusk, a huge impact hits the cabin, and it knocks out one of the split log chinkings between the logs, and they peer out in the moonlight, and they can see six or seven of these creatures dancing around the cabin, and then all of a sudden the roof is being pelted with rocks and stones. The creatures are climbing up onto the roof, trying to beat their way in. Holy crap, you know, we got to tear apart the bunks, bolster the door, and they start shooting through the roof, and they're building up the fire, screaming and yelling all night long, please go away, we're going to go away, and everything's going to be fine in the morning. Well, the attack happens all night long. A reporter later, visiting the site about a week later, noted that he noticed that something had been digging under the foundation that night as well, trying to get in. Sun comes up, and the attack had not happened all night long, and everything's quiet, and they have the courage to unblock the door and open it up, and there's rocks and stones littered all the way around the cabin. Huge footprints, 13, 14, 15 inches long. They had bundled up a spare set of roof shakes, and that's all torn apart and scattered. And it's like, grab your guns, grab your tobacco, and let's get the hell out of here. So they walk back to Spirit Lake, end up meeting first Wilma Welch, the forest ranger's wife, and then minutes later talked to Bill and told him, Bill, fortunately we have an interview from Bill Welch around 1966 in the Columbian here in Vancouver, where he retold the story. And they go back to Kelso, and in the truck they're like, nobody say anything to anybody, they're gonna think we're nuts. Well, my joke is, what do they do? They get, first thing they do, get a drink.
Yeah.
They went to Blue Ox Tavern, and it was run by a fellow named William Secor. And fortunately, I've gotten to know distant family members of the Blue Ox Tavern. And that's a famous story in the family of when those five guys came in and told their story. And then after that, the story spread like wildfire. A few days later, it was published in the Longview Daily News. We had the Associated Press wire, so it spread at all newspapers all over the West Coast of the eight men up there on Mount St. Helens.
That's a pretty incredible story. So what intrigued you enough to go, hey, I should probably go out there and look for some evidence that this happened? I mean, that sounds like a pretty crazy thing to do for most people.
Well, yeah, and I've taken lots of folks up there. Well, not lots of folks, maybe dozen and a half. And when we get to the top of the butte and we're about to go down 1,000 feet, I've had about 80% of them chicken out and go back to camp because it's really, really dangerous.
Yeah.
But my gig, my bread and butter all my life is I'm a land surveyor. My dad was a land surveyor. And I can get a little kind of preachy about the future of Sasquatch research, but I really think that everyone has their own individual skills that they can apply to it. Part of land surveying is that you call me for a boundary survey to figure out your property corners. The first thing I do is a tremendous amount of document research. What surveyors have done before in the area, what have landowners done before, the railroad, the county, building county roads, anything that I can use in order to figure out your property boundaries. Then, after getting document evidence, I have to go and find the field evidence, the old iron pipes in the woods, or, you know, whatever I need to measure and survey to. Well, growing up in the 70s, I was always interested in the unexplained, you know, that kind of thing. So really, it was, just a matter of fate, I guess, that I showed up on the scene where I could apply those survey skills into the Ape Canyon story and some other projects I'm working on, because it's always that what if.
Yeah.
What if there is still some sort of evidence out there in the woods 100 years later of the cabin or the mine or something like. And so it just grabbed me, and I started to realize that after looking into it, there was no map of the cabin or the mine. It was just a really bad description. But I started to realize that it could, after all these years, this small area where it could be may have survived the 1980 eruption just through a weird topographic coincidence, honestly. And I just started going out there and I started looking for it.
When did you start looking for the cabin?
2011, in October, I believe. It was my first trip. By the time 2013 rolled around, I had done maybe 5 or 6 trips or so.
So it took you quite a while then.
Yeah, for sure. And at first I was just, doing day trips up there, which is really, really difficult. But I would go up to the top of Pumice Butte, and I knew it was down the east side of Pumice Butte, and I'd just poke my way along on every trip, going a little bit further, just thinking and looking and just listening to the wind and just thinking about, what makes sense as far as what little clues we had as far as where the cabin and mine were.
Okay. So pretty difficult terrain out there then?
Highly.
Yeah,
there's one little slip, and you're going to butt slide right down into the bottom of that cliff, or the bottom of the canyon, when, unfortunately, we do have record of a couple of people back in the 70s and one in 1950 who did die by slipping down into the canyon.
That does not sound like a fun way to go.
That's no, for it sure. is not.
So you're out there exploring in the woods. Do you go by yourself? Do you take people with you? Or?
Well, at first, for the first few trips, yeah. I did go by myself. But it was in the third week of June of 2013 where a group of friends, I was living here in town in Vancouver, and a group of friends are like, hey, you got to take us with you. We got to take us with you. And I'm like, okay. So altogether, there were 5 of us. Since then, I've done a couple of trips by myself, but it was mainly that trip in 2013. Again, there are 5 of us, and we get to the top of the butte, and everyone except myself and a friend, Gabe Temme, he was the only one that went down with me. And the key to finding that cabin site that year was that there was, at the time, there was only one photo of the cabin that was taken about a week later. And in the foreground of the cabin, you can see stumps that the miners had cut down the trees in order to build the cabin. Then that was it's a land surveying trick. Yeah. Stumps are used as references for property land corners, and stumps under certain condition can last a very, very long time out in the woods. I had talked to the head archaeologist at the Gifford Pinchot National Forest, and he confirmed that that east side of Pumice Butte had, there's no record of it being commercially logged. It's just plain too steep, and there's too few marketable trees down there. Yeah. So I knew that if I could find stumps, I'd be close. And Gabe and I just made our way down a little bit further. Gabe was great because he's really not a Sasquatch dude. He was just out there having fun.
Yeah, playing in the woods.
Yeah, fun in the woods. And we found one. And so I was able to bounce stuff off of him. And he said, well, that makes sense. Or no, I don't see that. Let's try something else. So we found a stump. We found another stump. We found another stump. And I break out the metal detector. And we were able to find, at first we found an old baling wire. There's a story about that wire, and nails, and then we eventually found the foundation. We found one of their spoons. We found the foundation of the cabin with the nail still driven into it, right?
Oh, wow.
The fun part about the baling wire is that I always thought it was just a baling wire, but there is a photo taken a week after the attack. And the miners never returned except for once. 2 of the miners went up there with reporters and some rangers to show them the cabin site and everything. And there's a photo of Fred Beck and Leroy Smith inside the cabin. And believe it, you can actually see the wire is bent in a very specific kind of nature. And you can actually see that wire in the 1924 photo. And I know, I know it's exactly that. It was used as sort of a loop on a spit to hang their coffee pot over their fire. So basically that was the adventure of finding the cabin. And since there, I've been up there like 12 times or something, taking friends up there. Still a little bit more work to do. I need to map the site. Almost all the features, the miners had built a ladder and identified the ladder site. We finally identified the spring. So we've found all the features related to the story. Now I need to go up there and map it.
So did you find anything that you believe to be evidence of Sasquatch when you were up there?
Not related to Ape Canyon. However, yes. My friend Shane Corson is a great, great friend, and he's really heavily involved. He's a member of the Olympic Project, and he's heavily involved.
Yeah, I know who he is.
Yeah, he's a good guy.
I know who he is.
He's terrific. That's a shame, because when you and I were up at Mount Hood a couple of weeks ago, Shane was there, and I should have introduced him.
Yeah.
Anyway, Shane taught me the term confirmation experience in Sasquatch, where you, Jason, you're sitting right here in front of me, and that's my confirmation experience. We're on the radio, and I'm looking at you, with Bigfoot, it's like that. So up there on St. Helens, no, I can't say I had that kind of evidence of Sasquatch related at all. However, some weird things happened, and it was on that week of June of 2013 where we're all back. I had just found the cabin, and I was kind of giddy and everything. It's still like a dream. It's like how can this possibly happen? Anyway, so we're hanging around at camp, and it's dusk, and we're about a mile from the center of the mountain. And there's a little bit of a draw, and then the mountain starts shooting up in front of us, maybe a quarter mile of away, and you can hear up on the ridge line someone is up there about a quarter of a mile away talking really, really loud. My friend Brad called it it sounded like drunken bikers, you know. there was howling, chattering, on and on. Quiet. Then about 2 or 3 minutes later, down the ridge, maybe 800 feet or so, there's a second one. Same chattery, howly thing, and you can hear it really clearly. And there, two are talking back and forth, back and forth. Then a few minutes later, there's a third one. There's a fourth one. Then way down, headed towards the Lewis River, down the Muddy. Nobody else heard it, but I think I heard a fifth one. And it goes on all night long, and I have no idea. And presumably, they were talking about us, but it goes all night long, and all you can do is get in your tent and pull your sleeping bag up over your ears and try to go to sleep, you know. So in the morning, the sun's just barely coming up, and I can see it through my tent screen. And I can hear him talking up there, up on the ridge again.
Yeah. Wow.
And so about an hour later, we get up for coffee, and we're all getting coffee, and Ben is like, "Did you guys smell that?" And no, but apparently there was a smell right in camp that was so strong and musky and animal-like that it woke him up.
Oh, wow.
And so we were like, "Well, did you look out?" And he's like, "Hell no, no, I didn't look out."
No, thank you.
But about 2 years later, about a mile from camp, we found a whole series of blobby prints in the sand and the ash, but one of them was good enough to cast. So yeah, we cast it and copied it. And it's, now Brad has the original and I have a copy, but some of the other copies that are at Cliff Berrickman's North American Bigfoot Center in Boring.
So cool, Oregon. Yeah. That's so, a cool place.
Yeah. Oh, it's great.
So why is it so important to you that this story is heard and validated?
Well, why do we preserve the pyramids? You know, why do we preserve Stonehenge? These physical historical sites we preserve because they're important. You know, there's something that happened in our civilization thousands of years ago, and we preserve it as a historic site to give us a touchstone where we're reaching across time and the ether and shaking hands with these people who built Stonehenge or the pyramids or whatever, you know. And it makes history more real and more relevant to us. And you know, I'm a history nerd, and I love all old stories, especially the weird ones. And so those stories are incredibly important to preserve because I feel it gives us a better understanding of ourselves and where we fit into 2025 right now. You know, no matter what, Ape Canyon or Sasquatch or whatever, that's why these stories need to be preserved. And that's my gig. I mean, goodness knows there's lots of Sasquatch stories out there.
Yeah.
But the ones that grab me the most are like Ape Canyon. What if there is some sort of physical component to the story that could still be around? And that's when I end up midlife crisis all over again, started re-researching the damn thing and seeing there was a great one in 69 where a left-hand yield turn sign, you know, just a metal sign, was sighted and saw it was bent and scratched by a hairy creature crossing the road just north of Tacoma. And I'm trying to track down that sign just for fun, you know.
Right.
Anyway, those are the stories that I enjoy the most. And that's basically my contribution to the research community. And I think that everybody has some sort of skill to contribute to the research community. And if you happen to be interested in Sasquatch too, that's great. Yeah. You know, I think that radio show hosts, carpenters, plumbers, IT guys, everyone has a skill set. I've met so many big brains and a lot smarter than me. And I've known anatomists, you know, anthropologists, microscopists, primatologists, all kinds of interesting people. And they happen to be interested in the Bigfoot phenomenon. Yeah. And they're applying their skill set to it as well. So with that, I think that is the future of Bigfoot research. When I see a print, I don't know anything about, well, I know a little bit, but anything about primate, you know, relic hominid, morphology and an anatomy. So, but I have good friends who do. So I call them and say, what do you think? And then when they think that there's some sort of weird, juicy piece of historical thing that could be found out there, they call me and give me,
that makes sense.
Give me a project. And actually that's what happened about 2 or 3 weeks ago at Mount Hood. Some guy gave me this little booklet from 1950 and he up in Alaska. Yeah. And he's like, this is a really great story. It's your job to find out where this happened. It's like, yeah, thanks, dude.
Well, hopefully you figure it out.
Yeah, I don't know, just baby steps.
Is it public knowledge where the cabin is, or that's something you prefer to keep unknown to the public?
Yeah, I want to keep it unknown to the general public because, now I have told friends, you know, under threat of bodily harm if they spread the news. I have told the people who should know, like the Gifford Pinchot archaeologist. Actually, Matt and I have hopefully a trip this year because he hasn't been there. The thing is about the cabin site, and you know, the story was known forever. And in 1977, there was a great guy, a friend of mine, he's passed now, but he became head of the volcanic monument ranger for Gifford Pinchot. He did a study in his young ranger days of doing a survey of historical resources for the forest. I talked to Jim about it. Jim Neeland is his name. And he said that they didn't know where the cabin was, but they listed it as an historical resource for the forest so that when it was found, it would be automatically protected.
Oh, that's right. Really good.
Yeah. So the volcanic monument, of course, everything is protected up there.
Yeah.
But before the monument, the Ape Canyon cabin and mine were already automatically protected, even though they didn't know where it was. And so that's why I don't tell everybody exactly where it is. Two reasons. One is that it's an historical resource and it's protected by under the United States of America. Yeah. But the other thing is I don't want to be liable of people going up there and dying over and over again because it's really dangerous. It's really, really dangerous.
So tell me about the movie you got coming out on the 22nd?
May 22nd, yes, at the Kickens Theater at 7 o'clock in the evening. I'm thrilled. People have come to me through the years. It's like, we got to make an Ape Canyon documentary. Oh, okay. You know, things kind of, you know, fall apart. But I ended up, a friend called me, I want to make a documentary. And I'm like, okay, wait a minute. My friend Seth Breedlove, who runs a production company called Small Town Monsters, they do great work. And so I told my friend, I go, wait, Seth and I have been talking about this for years. So I call Seth and I'm like, it's now or never, man. And so he was like, I can't pass this up. Pass this opportunity up. So about a year ago, a little bit over a year, we started filming. He put a good pal, Eli Watson, in charge of the production. And so Eli and I spent about 3, 4, 5 weeks filming up on the mountain. We got great interviews with family members of the miners and put together this documentary called The Siege of Ape Canyon. It's about an hour and a half long.
Okay.
And the broadcast where it's actually going to get really, really released is going to be somewhere in fall. But it's a Southwest Washington story and it should be seen. And so it's sort of as a vanity project. I booked the Kickens Theater.
That's a great place for you.
Yeah, I think it's great. I love the Kickens. And so it's one night only world premiere of The Siege of Ape Canyon. And some folks, Cliff Berrickman's going to be there. Good friend who's also in the movie, John Pickering, is going to be there. Eli's going to try to make it up. So we're going to have a little bit of Q&A afterwards.
And, that's really cool.
There's a good pub right around the corner. I might get a couple of beers and just chat with people.
Sounds like a good time.
Oh, it'd be great.
So what do you hope people get out of seeing the movie?
A better understanding of our history.
Yeah.
Honestly, yeah. When I started the Ape Canyon Project, talking with people who knew the story and were involved in the community, they were like, you know, Ape Canyon is like, you know, being canned into the circular file of tall tale and legend.
Yeah.
You know, people are questioning, did these guys even exist? What's going on? Well, no, these guys did exist. And we have found the cabin a year and a half ago. We finally found the mine entrance. And so this really, really did happen. As they said it happened, being attacked by mountain devils, I do not know. That said, there was one piece of evidence that showed up a few years ago. And as I remember, during the attack of July the 10th, they're shooting through the roof and everything.
Yeah.
Right inside the perimeter of the foundation of the cabin, we ended up finding this very, very old brass cartridge right in the middle of it, a few inches underground. Measured it, checked out the butt stamp, and it was a 30-30 Winchester, and that's what Fred Beck, I believe he was shooting a 30-30. But anyway, it matched Fred's gun. Yeah. So maybe there's more brass cartridges up there, but I think that mainly it's an understanding of the Ape Canyon story. And really, you know, I've seen stuff written about Ape Canyon and a couple of other segments and movies and stuff, but I got to tell you, I'm Mark Marcel, and I approve this message. This is the Ape Canyon movie that should have been made.
That's great. So you said it's May 22nd at 7 p.m. at Kickens Theater?
Yes.
And how do people obtain tickets for that?
The easiest way, I believe their website is kickenstheater.com, or just Google Kickens Vancouver, Washington.
Okay.
And you'll see the link. Pre-sale tickets are $13, and then it's $15 at the door.
So you save a couple bucks by ordering online.
Yeah, and do it quick, because I hear ticket sales are blowing up already.
All right, I'll have to get mine really soon, man. So over the last 20-30 years, Sasquatch has become pretty much mainstream with all the TV shows. And how do you feel about that?
I'm fine with it.
Yeah.
I'm totally fine with it. But mind you, you just said it, it's TV.
Yes.
It's YouTube. You know, it's entertainment, right? And you have to take it with that grain of salt. It is entertainment. There have been plenty of TV shows, and some of the television shows regarding Sasquatch are pretty good. Some of them are just garbage. They're terrible. I will not name names, even though I want to. They're just garbage. But it's entertainment.
Yeah.
Really, it's entertainment. And I'm all right with it, because the more that we talk about it as an academic subject, or the more that we talk about it, if you have had some sort of that confirmation experience, it's okay to talk about it.
Yeah.
As we say, you know, in the UFO community, if you see something, say something. And the more that we talk about it, the more it's going to be normalized and get it out of the realm of taboo or, you know, fear of ridicule or, you know, being embarrassed to talk about it, honestly.
Yeah.
Honestly, I'm all for it. The pop culture is cool, but really, if you're really interested in Sasquatch phenomenon and want to get involved, how can I get involved? Number one, read. Read a paper book. And there are some very good books out there, some stuff by John Green, Chris Murphy. There are some great books out there on Sasquatch, and start reading. Also, the thing that helps too is read something related that you're interested in, like plants. Native, you know, local indigenous food sources, salmon, whatever, you know, outdoors skills, you know, all that kind of thing, because all that comes together as a skill set in getting involved in Sasquatch.
Do you think the government knows that Sasquatch exists and just for some reason isn't telling us, whether it's, say they want to, they'd have to protect the forest they're logging and that kind of stuff, and if there was, you know, Sasquatch out there?
If you're inferring a government cover up, some sort of cabal or something like that, I tend to think not.
Yeah.
I don't think they're interested. As far as the government, of course, we're talking, you know, the government involves, you know, the city meter maid or, you know, county commissioners or whoever. It's shocking how many individual people who are public servants in the government have had their own experience. Mitch McConnell. out of Kentucky. He had his own experience as well. You know, all these people have had experiences. But as far as like a wide-reaching government plan to keep Bigfoot secret, I tend to think not. And I'm going to crib a story that I got from a friend. There's no need for that. There's no need to have it under wraps. And unfortunately, the reason why is because there's plenty of half-baked ideas. I don't want to call it the tinfoil hat crowd, but it is a tinfoil hat crowd that come up with some pretty interesting things. I still listen to what they have to say and take it into consideration, but I can't find any evidence of it. But it's those kind of people who appear as wackos or nuts. Yeah. And that is the thing why the government doesn't have to have a big cover-up plan or any kind of conspiracy to keep it quiet, because these folks with really outlandish ideas are making everyone else look stupid and ridiculous. Oh, it's like, oh, you're involved with Sasquatch. Oh, you must wear the hat then, you know, kind of thing.
So. Yeah, a lot of people believe that Bigfoot is a paranormal creature, like it's a spirit or something like that. What's your take on that?
The thing is about it is that I tend to, you know, there's different camps, if you will, in the research, you know, what do you think this phenomenon is? And honestly, there's no empirical evidence right now, right? So none of us know for certain. That being said, I tend to fall into the North American wood ape camp, where it is it's a flesh and blood animal, right? But that being said, there are folks, like you mentioned, of, you know, cloaking interdimensional beings. Some of I've known people who dropped out of the research community because they convinced that it was a demon, you know, it scared them, frankly.
Yeah.
And so they dropped the whole thing. So that being said, because none of us really, really know, when we listen to somebody's ideas and maybe they have some sort of evidence, to throw them out as wackos and everything is really, really wrong.
Yeah.
You're disenfranchising them, you're alienating them, but also you're throwing the baby out with the bathwater, because even if they have come to some sort of conclusions, which I think coming to a conclusion in this case is pretty darn dangerous, you know, right now we are, I know of a couple of people who are right on the edge of actually employing the scientific method. They're coming up with some pretty interesting stuff. But for the most part, we're in the investigatory stage. We're in the data collection stage of this, of researching this phenomenon. So when you have someone talking about cloaking or whatever, you're throwing the baby out with the bathwater by, you know, by saying, oh, you're nuts, and that's just nonsense, you know, because there might be something there. There might be something there, and you should be paying attention to it.
Yeah, I kind of feel that way too, but a lot of people in the local Bigfoot community won't even want to talk about Bigfoot being anything more than a hairy creature walking around the woods. So
yeah, you're right. And we have friends who are shy a little bit about, even though they're great friends and everyone loves them, they're kind of shy about being too terribly involved, because they, you know, and my friend John, he has some pretty interesting ideas, and he feels like he's the white elephant in the room. And I'm like, nonsense, you know, you need to show up, because you have some really interesting things to share.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I'm the Sesame Street model. I think, I think that everyone in the neighborhood is welcome.
That's a good way to look at it. Cause I mean, the more you can learn from other people, the better off you are. Mm-hmm. So that's the way I try to do things as a paranormal investigator. When I'm going to look in, you know, I'll go to the ghost conference and stuff, and you know, go out there, and like, you got 30 different teams with 30 different strategies, and you know, 29 of them are pretty much close to the same, but they're always that one.
Yeah.
Like, wait a minute.
Yeah, that's all right.
And just hope you're not that one. You know? So what do you believe, in your opinion, is the greatest piece of evidence for the existence of Sasquatch?
Probably the Patterson-Gimlin film.
Pretty convinced on that one?
Absolutely. Yeah, pretty much. You know, nothing is 100%.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's 100%. Two reasons why. It's because it's been analyzed to death from all kinds of different directions, all kinds of different angles, analyzing the film. I mean, Sasquatch nerds are like really nerdy about it. And they're like, they've tracked down exactly where Roger Patterson had the film developed and what kind of film stock it was used on, what kind of camera and all this kind of jazz. So from a film perspective, it's been analyzed to death. But then also there's been such great cleanup work on the Patterson-Gimlin film, where you can actually see muscle forms moving as Patty starts walking across the room. And it's like pretty amazing stuff. Enough so that's where Dr. Jeff Meldrum, who's the anatomist, comes into play, where he's analyzed it to death too.
Yeah.
And every time I talk to Dr. Jeff, I always learn something new. He's a great guy.
Yeah, I talked to him at the conference.
Oh, good. Yeah.
Hopefully I'll have him on the show soon.
Oh, he's terrific.
He said he would. We'll see. I'll have to email him soon and get him on.
But really, I think that is probably the strongest piece of evidence that we have right now that everyone knows about. Yeah. However, there's plenty of other evidence out there as well, dealing with, yes, there are some samples that have been analyzed. One of them with Dr. Melba Ketchum, really, that whole project really went south. But there are other DNA samples floating around out there. Prints are great. I think a lot of prints, especially if they're prints that have been cast with plaster or hydrocal, but also photographed. And then these days, a free app on your phone, you can do 3D scans of it. And that combination of all those three of an individual print, it's pretty darn astounding when you get it to that print expert, someone who knows how a footstep works, and have them take a look at it. And, you know, a lot of the good people that I talk to, who I send it to, sometimes they're like, no. Other times they're like, maybe.
Yeah.
You know, you don't know, but there's indications there. So there's lots of good evidence out there.
I've heard stories about the eruption in 1980 that people saw Sasquatches leaving the area, or even bodies of Sasquatches at that time. Yep. There's lots of stories. I don't know if you've heard about that or not, but I was reading about that the other day on the internet, and I thought that was an interesting story.
Yeah, I think that's been tracked down where it is enough so that it's a dead end.
Yeah.
There were stories of them being helicoptered out by military personnel, probably, or what seemed to be military helicopters. And it's been tracked down enough. Mainly a fellow, a friend of mine, John Kirk III, I started to get into it, and John and I talked about it a bit. And he was able to track it down basically to the dead end of where that story came from. And the last one was, I heard that from my cousin. She told me about it. And she was the primary source where the story got out. Then it was game of telephone after that.
Yeah, yeah.
But then that cousin has since passed on. So
it wouldn't surprise me if that story was true, to be honest.
Oh, really? Okay, yeah.
I mean, like, it may not be, but, like, it makes sense. I mean, if they're living up there, they would probably flee with all the other animals.
Oh, well, oh, fleeing. Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I thought you meant, like, helicoptered out. But
yeah. I mean, maybe. Yeah,
I mean, if they're helicoptering out Sasquatch, were they helicoptering out dead cougar and bear and deer and chipmunks? Yeah. Probably not.
They're probably like, what is this?
Yeah. But as far as running, absolutely. Because, I mean, you know, before that, there was like weeks and weeks and weeks of severe earthquakes.
Yeah.
And that was the mountains saying, stay the hell off of me because I'm going to blow, man.
Guys, bear back up.
Yeah. That's true.
And still not everybody did.
Yes.
I was only a month old when that happened. So.
Oh, you were a month old. Wow.
Yeah, I was a month old when that happened. I probably have ash from it in my baby book that my mom's collected. So
yeah.
I can remember, you know, we learned about it in school, and I can remember seeing my mom had some of that. And
I still have my Tupperware of the ash that came down on the porch.
I still like to go up there and explore at the museums and stuff up there. They got
it. Oh, yeah.
Those are always cool.
Yeah.
And then let's see, what else do we got here? What's next for you? What are you going to, you talked before, when we talked before, about maybe doing a book.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. No. Yeah, I am. You know, a friend, two friends, Scott and Hannah Violette, they're Sasquatch researchers.
Yeah, I've met Scott
before. Oh, okay,
in fact, I had him on the show when it was a podcast years ago when I first started doing this.
Yeah. Well, anyway, I might as well, like, you know, plug my friends. But they have a book that just came out.
Okay.
And Hannah called me and said, could you write the foreword?
Oh, nice.
And I was pretty honored. And so the book just came out, and I talked to Hannah about it. I've been writing pretty much my whole life. I enjoy writing, and I just do it for fun. And I have some stuff that's published, but not that much. But writing that foreword for Scott and Hannah, man, I was in that zone again. It's like a drug, and I can't stop writing. So it finally got me to try to finish up the Ape Canyon book, hopefully this year.
Oh, good.
And hopefully this year.
You got like a publisher and all that, or are you just going to self-publish?
I am headed towards self-publishing, honestly. Friends have gone through a publisher, and it's kind of gone south financially.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So I'm probably going to self-publish it. However, I do have an editor who's agreed to edit it, and he's edited some stuff for me. He's involved in the Sasquatch research community. He's a great editor. He really cleaned up my work a lot. So I'm using him. So yeah, I have a book coming out, and then the movie, and then my continuing projects. That's a new midlife crisis every day of finding a bent sign or whatever.
Yeah. So now that you've got the movie done and everything, so are you going to still go out there and look for more evidence at the cabin?
Oh, always.
Yeah.
Yeah. No good research project worth its salt is ever done, regardless of Sasquatch or chemical geology or whatever. Any good research project is absolutely never done. Every time, it's really a fascinating phenomenon, because every time I'm thinking, oh, you know, that's pretty much it, it's kind of case closed, then suddenly a new lead shows up, you know, another avenue to pursue. So my friend calls me the apex predator of all things Ape Canyon. So anything related to Ape Canyon, yeah, I'm on it, man, like a bonnet, you know. So there's always more to do. But the thing about Ape Canyon is that the period of time that these miners were actually working this project was about 6 years. But I've been on this project for like about 15 years or more. And so it's kind of like double the life in order to try to track everything down. I'm not doing this full time because I don't make any money at it. But I have another project down in Southwest Oregon, Curry County, where there was a series of events that took place over the period of about 30 years down at Thompson Flat, this large bipedal Sasquatch creature. Yeah. And so given that ratio of 6 years worth of Ape Canyon work, and it took me 15 years, Thompson Flat is going to take me about 60 years. So all I have to do is like live to be 150, and that one will be done.
Well, science is advancing, so it's possible.
I got to take better care of my body.
They're talking about, I saw this interesting thing online the other day where they're saying soon enough they're going to be able to transplant your head on a healthy body.
Oh, yeah, just like Futurama.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, cool.
So just don't get brain cancer or something. It'll be fine, you know? So after the movie premieres on the 22nd at Kiggins, you said it's going to come out in, you said May?
No, in fall.
In fall. Okay, yeah, so in fall how will people see it then? Is it going to be on like streaming
services? different kind of streaming platforms. Small Town Monsters is a production company, and they're working on actually getting their own streaming platform going right now.
Cool.
But Seth Breedlove, who's the guru there, he's working on setting it out to his different distributors to see what the best options are for distributing it. But Small Town Monsters has a great reputation, and it's going to be easily available.
Awesome. Yep. Well, is there anything else you'd like to share before we end the show here?
No, I don't, but always just love hanging out with you. Yeah. Thanks for calling me, man.
For sure. Yeah, I was like, because it's a great story, first of all.
Oh, yeah.
It's a lot of fun. It's a story I've heard about for years and never really learned much about it until recently.
That's the thing about Ape Canyon, especially with us, Clark County, Southwest Washington. Everybody has heard this story in one version. Hey, do you ever hear that story about Ape Canyon? And no. And I start telling people about it. Like, wait a minute. I've heard this story.
Yeah, exactly. Because they always have it on those like shows where they just do like three or four different paranormal topics. And it's kind of one of those. Oh, yeah. I remember back in the 20s when this happened. And it's just a quick little blurb. But nobody's ever really tells the complete story.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Until I showed up.
Until you showed up.
Humbly speaking.
Hopefully we get more of the story. Who knows? And see what you can find. Because I imagine... You said you've talked to family members of some of the miners and stuff, but they probably didn't share much of the story back then other than at the bar. So,
well, it's an interesting thing because the youngest was Leroy, and his son and daughter are still alive. And I've gotten to be good friends with his daughter. Betty is 75-ish or so. And the fascinating thing is that some of the miners talked a lot about it.
Yeah.
Some did not. And Leroy was quoted in one interview at the time in 24. He said, I don't know what that was that I shot at when I was coming back from the spring, but I know I never want to have to do anything with it ever again.
Wow.
And he meant it, because when I contacted Betty, she knew the Ape Canyon story because she grew up in Kelso Longview.
Yeah.
And she knew the Ape Canyon story, but she didn't know it was her dad and her grandfather and her uncle until I told her.
That's crazy.
I let the cat out of the bag. My first call, I was so nervous, and I didn't start talking Sasquatch on a cold call with a nice older woman. But eventually it came out, and she was shocked because she loved her dad very much, and she said that her family is very, very honest and very, very straightforward. And she was shocked that her dad never told her. And that's so Leroy meant it. He didn't want to have anything to do with it ever.
Must
have
just scared him that bad.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, there's a lot of things that we'd like to forget in our lives, and I'm sure that was
and
one
that
of
was
them.
One of them, yeah.
I don't think I could handle a situation like that myself. I mean, I have my own, you know, I don't have any Sasquatch encounters, but I've had...
You're a paranormal researcher.
Yeah. And
you're
like, so, I mean, I've had some ghost encounters and some alien type stuff, but of course I didn't spend a whole lot of time in the woods either, so...
Well, that's interesting because I do know Sasquatch researchers who have had what could be ghost experience, and it could, the best way to describe it, some sort of unusual ghostly experience. And frankly, it scared the hell out of them.
Yeah.
And they don't like talking about it. They have no problem with an 8-foot-tall monster in the woods, but they don't want to talk about ghosts.
Yeah, you can run away from Bigfoot, but you can't hide from the ghosts. Yeah, right. All right, on that, we're going to end the show. I really appreciate having you come on. And before we go ahead and tell everybody where the movie is and where it's going to be and all that kind of stuff and how they can get tickets.
Downtown Vancouver, Washington, the historic Kiggins Theater. They're a really great organization, and you can get it, I believe, at KigginsTheater.com. And it's $13 for pre-sale tickets, and you can get them online at the theater website, and $15 at the door. And I'll see you on May 22nd at 7 o'clock.
All right. Sounds good.
Right.
Thank you. Thank you for listening to Hassling the Paranormal with Jason Hassler. I hope you enjoyed the show, and we'll tune in next month for an all-new episode of Hassling the Paranormal right here on the KXRW 99.9 FM. I wish I found some better sounds no one's ever heard. I wish I had a better voice that sang some better words. I wish I found some chords in an order that is new. I wish I didn't have to rhyme every time. Programming like this is made possible by support from High Five Cannabis, your local cannabis connection in Vancouver and Stevenson, Washington. High Five offers flower, concentrates, edibles, tinctures, topicals, and more. Whether you're new to cannabis or know what you need, their staff is available to assist. If you go to highfivecannabis.com, spelled H-I-G-H, the number 5, cannabis.com, you can learn about their specials like Munchy Monday, Senior Tuesdays, Waxy Wednesdays, and Loyalty Thursdays. Again, that's highfivecannabis.com. Oh, you know it. Hi, I'm Nikki Klock, editor of Vancouver Family Magazine. For over 20 years, we've been covering local news, recreation, travel, education, parenting, personalities, and more. We connect your family to local people, places, ideas, helpful resources, and local stories. Pick up your copy every month at over 300 locations all over Clark County or read online at VancouverFamilyMagazine.com. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and X for even more local news and family fun at Vancouver Family. If you're looking for pizza in East Vancouver, consider visiting Giuliano's Pizzeria in the Cascade Park Fisher's Landing neighborhood. For 37 years, Giuliano's has been a choice for Clark County residents. Giuliano's has a casual classic rock atmosphere, open 7 days a week, and they provide table service allowing you to relax and enjoy your meal with family and friends. If you have a large crowd to feed, Giuliano's can deliver 6 or more extra large pizzas to your office or event. More information can be found at giulianospizza.com. Support for KXRW Vancouver comes from On Point Removal Services. On Point Removal Services is a Vancouver, Washington-based junk removal service that proudly serves all of the Clark County area and beyond. Offering residential, office, and construction junk removal, On Point will do all of the loading, pickup, hauling, and cleanup on your project. And On Point is fully licensed and insured. For more information, visit their website at onpoint-removal.com.
KXRW is supported by founding partners Morel Inc. Print and Marketing. Since 1993, Morel Inc. has offered high-quality, creative, and innovative solutions from their woman-owned, union-staffed, state-of-the-art print shop. Morel Inc.'s experienced staff uses the latest technology to solve clients' marketing needs. Find Morel Inc. at morelinc.com. That's MORELINK.com.
The Colombian calls singer-songwriter Al Perez a soulful performer masterfully woven, whether he's on his acoustic guitar solo or backed by his five-member live band. Al Perez has thrilled local and abroad audiences for over two decades with his unique blend of light rock, R&B, fan-favorite covers, and a touch of Latin flavor. To book Al Perez or hear his latest Warrior Records release, Love Revolution, go to warriorrecords.com/Al-Perez. That's warriorrecords.com/Al-Perez.
With your hand in my hand, your body kissed by the sun, and we'll be living.
If you enjoyed today's show and want to know more about the Abe Canyon story, you can come meet Mark and see the documentary The Siege of Abe Canyon at Kiggins Theater right here in Vancouver, Washington on May 22nd at 7 p.m. I hope to see you there.